This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Generation Next on Joy 94.9. It's another Monday night. My name's Sekid and I'm joined by Emma again, who was here a couple of weeks ago. Now, you obviously came back, so it wasn't too traumatic the first time around.
No, I was very nervous, but I'm feeling a bit better now.
Yeah. I remember the first time I was on radio, I was so wound up and so nervous. Then when I left the studio, I just needed to release some tension, and some guys were like sitting at a bar somewhere and they go, "How are you?" to everyone walking past, and I went, "Effing great." It's not what I said, you know. I think you can imagine what I said, but yes, no. Radio is fun here on Joy 94.9. I don't know why I went into that story. What are we talking about today, Emma?
Well, Benjamin Law talks to us about the Emerging Writers Festival. We've got Senator Sarah Hanson-Young speaking to us on the phone. Jacob's got the top five rules for Twitter use.
Yes, I put these together yesterday. I posted them online and I'll say the reaction was mixed. So, yes, my top five rules for Twitter. Also, we're talking about your parents' attitudes about the gays. Have they changed? Are they the same? Have they evolved at all? We'll be talking, because I think Emma and I, you and I have a fairly sort of different experiences, so we'll see. And we're also talking about the rapture on Saturday that didn't happen. Talk about all that, plus more on Generation Next. Now, we spoke earlier to Sarah Hanson-Young on the phone, the Green Senator, and this is a little bit of what it sounded like. On the line now, we have Green Senator Sarah Hanson-Young, who's taking time out of this week's estimates hearing to speak to us here on Generation Next on Joy 94.9. Sarah, thank you very much for joining us.
That's all right. Thanks for having me.
Now, firstly, I want to go to the news very recently. You were at an Equal Love rally in Adelaide, which was crashed. Can you tell us what happened?
Yes, well, I've been looking forward to speaking at a Equal Love rally in Adelaide, which is, of course, my own hood. And I've been looking forward to it for quite some time, because it seems as though every time the Adelaide crew organised something, I wasn't in Adelaide. So for me, I'd been looking forward to it. And the day started quite well. We had some wonderful speakers, and in particular, a high school student who talked about she'd just recently come out at school and talked about the impact of making that decision and the support that she got from her close circle of friends, but of course how important it was that she felt supported, because it's a pretty rough place in the schoolyard to be coming out as a you know, young woman in the age of 16 or 17. So she spoke wonderfully, and I talked about the need for marriage equality and tolerance. I talked about the need for national consistent anti-discrimination laws, so that students like her could feel like they had the protection of the law, not just the protection of the circle of friends that she had. And on the issue of marriage, I, of course, pushed the need for a conscience vote on my private member's bill, ensuring that both Tony Abbott and Julia Gillard hear loud and clear that they need to grant their members of Parliament a conscience vote, so that we can rid Australia of the terrible discrimination within the Marriage Act. Let's allow people to marry the person they love, regardless of their gender or sexuality. Now, as the rally went on, and we spoke, there was a wonderful musical performance that participated while there was a mock wedding taking place by a minister who is a registered celebrant, and she was talking about how, as a religious minister, it would be a nice thing for her to be able to marry people that loved each other and wanted to be committed, and that religion and the idea that some people have that marriage should only be between a man and a woman and anything else undermines that, she said, well, she scoffed at that and said it's just simply not true. The more people who get married, the more couples that want to commit to each other, the stronger the institution of marriage becomes. And as this was happening, ironically enough, the woman having the microphone being the actual Christian minister giving conducting this mock wedding, we were gate crashed, or wedding crashed even, by a bunch of very, I guess, fundamental conservative street preachers. Yeah. And they didn't just come with their banners, they came with a portable PA system and started to try and drown out the message that the crowd was giving and that the minister and was giving at the time. It was pretty, it kind of happened very quickly, and they stuck around, and unfortunately a very, very happy day and one of celebration turned pretty ugly because some people decided to preach hate rather than preach love.
Just while we're on the subject of equality and gay marriage, the Greens currently have a bill before Parliament in favour of marriage equality. Is that right?
That's right. So I currently have a private member's bill sitting on the Senate table, waiting to be debated and voted on. And it is it will remove the discrimination in the Marriage Act. It will allow couples to marry regardless of their sexuality and their gender. And it's an important piece of legislation. We need to get this passed in this term of government, and we need those in the community who want to see this discrimination gone, lobbying their local members of parliament and Julia Gillard and Tony Abbott to give all members of parliament the right to a conscience vote so we can get this bill passed.
Yeah, Julia Gillard has repeatedly said that she won't have a conscience vote, and I think probably Tony Abbott is thinking along the same lines. I guess what we're holding out for really is for the Labor conference this December. Given what we've seen from Julia Gillard, particularly recently in Victoria, how confident are you that the party will change its policy?
Look, I'm not confident that the Labor Party will change its policy. I think what we may be able to get is, of course, a conscience vote of the Labor Party conference granting their members a conscience vote on the issue. And if we can get that, that at least moves us forward. You know, I think it's really sad that we have the Prime Minister, a woman who, of course, has made her own choices about being able to live with her partner in the lodge, no less, and has made a choice about the fact that she's not getting married. Well, that's all very well and good, but how about other couples who'd like to be able to legitimately make that choice to marry or not? And it's simply about equality. It shouldn't be about the politics of the day. This is about basic human rights, basic equality. And, you know, as a married woman and as somebody who didn't even have to think twice about making that decision myself in terms of whether it was illegal or not, I think it's shameful that somebody like me is able to just take for granted that right, while other couples that I know who are desperate to be able to share their love for each other, with their family, with the rest of the world, under what is a very important institution, and that is of marriage. I think it's sad that in 2011, Australia and the leaders that we currently have in Tony Abbott and Julia Gillard just can't get it together. I mean, they need to pull their heads out of the sand on this. They can have their view. Absolutely. No one's suggesting that, that people can't disagree with it. But when the majority of Australians believe that it shouldn't be such a big deal, people should be able to do what they want, well, let's get the politics out of it and let love reign.
Preaching to the choir, Senator Sarah Hanson-Young. Emma.
So what do you actually make of Julia Gillard's refusal to even meet with people in favour of gay marriage?
Well, I think it's sad that the Prime Minister, if that's true, the Prime Minister isn't making time to meet with the constituents of the country she leads on this issue. This is a very important issue for people. It's not just important from couples who want to marry each other. You know, the most impassioned correspondence and stories I hear from people about this are not the couples necessarily involved. It's their loved ones, their families, their friends who can't stomach the fact that their closest loved ones and friends do not have the same rights as other people. And they're the constituents that I think Julia Gillard should be meeting with. People, everyday Australians who hold values of love for family, love for country, and love for equality. And just because we believe that people in same-sex relationships, people regardless of their gender or sexuality, should be able to marry, does not diminish that love that we have for our friends and family.
Yeah, Julia Gillard said a couple of weeks ago that she was speaking about the Greens, and the Greens don't share ordinary Australians' love of being hardworking and all that sort of stuff. Do you think it was a kind of veiled dig at homosexuals, I suppose?
I think that speech from Julia Gillard was just total bollocks, wasn't
yeah,
it? It was one of the most embarrassing and demeaning things, I think, of the position of Prime Minister, to suggest that the 2 million people in the country who voted Green, who support the Greens, somehow don't have a love for country, family, or acknowledge the virtues of hard work. I mean, what a total insult to a huge swag of the population. And of course, it's absolutely untrue. You know, it is people who want to see equality in their for their friends, for their loved ones, for their sons, for their daughters, for their brothers, their sisters, for their cousins, because regardless of their sexuality, they should be able to get married. It is that love that is stronger than any petty political game that the Prime Minister of the day may want to play.
Yes. Now, speaking of our brothers and sisters in Uganda are under particular sort of pressure. And recently we've seen Foreign Minister Kevin Rudd condemn a bill in Uganda that would make being gay a capital offence. Was that the right response, do you think, from the government? Do you think they should have gone further?
Well, look, I, of course, have moved several motions in the Parliament on this particular issue, and ironically, the first few, the first couple were voted down in the Parliament because it was seen as to be too much of a complicated foreign affairs matter for the Australian Senate to tackle, which of course is the lingo and the jargon that's used when the government or the opposition don't want to be seen to be making a decision on a particular issue. But eventually we actually did get a motion passed, really calling on the Ugandan government to stop this oppression and communicate Australia's dissatisfaction and outrage at this issue. I think the way the government has responded, of course, given their general nature to be timid on this issue, has probably been in a positive step. I think we need to keep a good watchful eye on it, though. We don't want to see, when we are fighting for rights here in Australia for same-sex couples, for people of different sexualities to have equal rights, for the national unification of anti-discrimination laws, when we're fighting for those things, the last thing we want to see is countries like Uganda being able to even toughen and tighten their appalling record when it comes to the treatment of homosexuals.
Absolutely. I think it was a really positive outcome that the bill was thrown out. So I'd like to change tack slightly and ask you about one area of the budget that concerns you, the school chaplains program. Do you have any plans to lobby for the program to be scrapped?
Yes, absolutely. And I've put a very clear call out to the government to suggest that the $222 million that is included in that was handed down in the budget 2 weeks ago, included for an extension of the chaplaincy program, that the chaplaincy program in its current form needs to be scrapped. It is a ridiculous amount of taxpayers' money to be spent on a program that does not guarantee that young people who are in that time of our lives, being very vulnerable, do not have access necessarily to the qualified services that they need. I think it's ridiculous that federal money, taxpayers' money, public dollars, are being spent on a program where we don't guarantee that the expertise, skills and qualifications of support for students is paramount. I honestly believe the program needs to be reviewed and redefined into a student support program where the people giving support to students are the people that students need, and that would need to be a conversation with the school community. Some school communities would need somebody in that position with different emphasis. Some people may need a youth worker. Other people may need more of the kind of a straight counsellor position. Some schools may decide they need somebody to liaise, to help students liaise with government agencies, such as foster agencies, Centrelink, those types of things. It would be up to the school to decide and the school community to decide what type of service they need. But for heaven's sake, and I say that deliberately, let's make sure that taxpayers' money is being spent on qualified support. I don't think we should be subjecting students to the type of program that doesn't guarantee that the people advising them are qualified.
Excellent. I spoke to Kate Ellis last year when she was the youth minister, and she kind of defended the chaplain's program, saying, you know, we should keep money for students rather than take it away, and that it wasn't being used to sort of proselytise. But I think recent events have sort of shown maybe it does need to be reviewed. Sarah Hanson-Young, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure having you.
It's been a pleasure to be able to chat and to get away from Senate estimates for a quick 10 minutes. So thank you.
It's been a busy, busy week for all of us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Cheers.
The hottest divas. Joy 94.9.
Generation Next on Joy 94.9, because Sarah Hanson-Young is a diva and a hot one at that.
She is awesome. I think we can all agree.
Yeah, I really liked that interview.
Me too. Very insightful.
Now, we're talking about public transport and whether you feel safe. And we were saying this before, I generally feel okay on public transport. I feel pretty well, you know, even catching a tram late at night. It's just the occasional wacko. Now, you've got a wacko story.
I do have a wacko story, and I usually feel pretty safe once I've actually been on the train myself. But it's the stations, I think, that take us by surprise. And Kensington Station on a Saturday night, somebody tried to wee on me, and I am not even joking.
Okay, so set it up. You're walking along. How did they try to wee on you?
I was wobbling along in my high heels far too late at night, and I don't know.
A bit of sick down the front, maybe.
Not quite that bad, but for those who've been at Kensington Station, you'll know that there's a bit of an underpass situation, which is scary at the best of times, but I noticed a bit of a stream coming from above me. I looked up and someone was pointing a very inappropriate piece of anatomy at me. And then he shouted out some very demeaning things, which made me wobble even faster in my high heels toward the train.
Oh, God.
Which then took 20 minutes to come, might I add.
Bloody metro. Now, you're telling it like you're laughing about it now, but that's horrifying.
It was. It was really awful. And thank God he didn't hit me. I don't have crazy bum cooties. But yeah, it was really awful. And I find myself very resentful of people who try to disturb the peace when we're all being so environmentally conscious and taking public transport at night.
And not peeing on passers-by.
Yeah. So if you're listening, dude,
yeah,
why did you do that? Yeah. Not very nice.
Not at all. If you've got a weird sort of person on the train, a weird public transport story, SMS us 0427 joy 949, email on air at joy.org.au. We want to hear from you. This is Generation Next.
Terror attack warning sounds like.
Now, we spoke earlier to Ben Law about Emerging Writers Festival, and this is it. This is Joy 94.9. Now, next month, Melbourne is lucky enough to again host the Emerging Writers Festival, bringing together the hundreds of young and upcoming writers from across the country. One of those writers coming into Melbourne for the event is Benjamin Law, and he's written for a list of publications, as long as your arm, on a range of subjects, and his first book, The Family Law, was released last year. Ben, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Emerging Writers Festival, how important is that in your calendar?
Well, this is going to be the second time that I've gone to the Emerging Writers Festival, but for ages I've known about its existence. But last year was the first time I went, and I was really, really impressed about how it was organised, the sort of events that were taking place. It's a really dynamic, fun sort of festival. I think people think of writers' festivals and I think something that's a bit stuffy or a bit boring or a bit lofty or a little bit self-righteous. But this is a lot of young writers, across so many fields, whether they've written books or blogs or whatever, and bashing out ideas and sharing a lot of knowledge and having a lot of fun, and a lot of boozy fun, I must say.
Yeah, I did read on the website today, they've set it up so that there's free Wi-Fi and there's cheap booze and coffee and stuff. So I guess what you said before about writers being stuffy kind of people, it doesn't quite weigh up when you look at it, the festival.
I think when you're young as well, when you're young and you're a writer, you know, writing is one of those things that's incredibly solitary, and often you're just at your desk trying to churn something out and bashing your head against the wall. And I think what events like the Emerging Writers Festival is really good for is meeting other people who are like you, or maybe doing similar stuff to you, but maybe a few years ahead of you, or you're trying to find out how to make a zine, or to get your blog up and running, or to have a really good idea about debate. So it's supposed to be fun, and certainly when I went last year, it was really, really great fun. You meet a lot of great people as well.
Definitely. Now, you'll be speaking at two events. Tell us about Business of Being a Writer.
Okay, well, this is an all-day event. It goes for 6 hours or something extraordinary. It's like this mammoth event. Maybe I've gotten that wrong. Maybe it's 3 hours and I'm just exaggerating it in my brain. But it's basically me hosting an event where people have signed up for a masterclass and want to know more about the business side of being a writer, and certainly when you are a freelance writer, it is a business. You need to know stuff about tax and accountancy, and you need to know other things like how to deal with editors and maintain good relationships with those people. So I'll be hosting that event and inviting people onto the stage like the writer Anita Heiss or Sarah Jansen, Mel Campbell and some other guys as well, about those nitty-gritty things, because that's sometimes the stuff that they don't teach you at university, and it's the stuff that they don't necessarily teach you at other places. And this is a pretty frank session about stuff that sometimes it's not polite to talk about as a writer. So another good sort of platform to exchange that knowledge.
Yeah, I guess people, when they think about writing, they think that you just sort of sit down and throw something together and then somebody immediately snaps it up, and it probably doesn't happen quite like that. Now, the other event you're involved in is Two Sides of the Coin, and it deals with the concept of make it till you fake it, and this is a philosophy I live by. Tell us about more about that event.
Well, these events are really funny, and what you're essentially doing, and I'm a part of this debate, but what you're doing that's sort of a non-traditional approach to a debate is you're essentially debating yourself. So the first side of the argument is making it, and I think I'm sharing the stage with other people who have either published books or have been on TV, all that sort of stuff. And some people might look at people like my fellow teammates and myself and say, well, they've made it. And then we have to sort of argue why we think making it is important, or perhaps why we have made it ourselves. And then we sit down, and then we get back up on stage again, and we tear ourselves to shreds. So it's a very schizophrenic approach to debating, but I think most writers have that element of mental illness in them anyway, so it's pretty conducive to getting us up on stage.
Yeah, definitely. It reminds me a bit of Year 8 debating classes, which I was involved in, and I ended up arguing positions that I completely disagreed with, but I found myself talking myself into believing them. It's quite bizarre.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. And, you know, you'll probably make a really good lawyer as well.
Now, The Family Law, it's your first book, and it's an account of your childhood growing up in an Asian Australian family. What inspired you to sit down and put that all into words?
Well, look, I've been doing it for a long time prior to actually writing it as a book. I write for a magazine called Frankie Magazine, and one of the things that our editors, the founding editor and our current editor, have always encouraged the writers to do is to write stuff about our own lives. And of course, if you're writing about your own life, you can't write about just yourself unless you're a hermit. You're not the only person in your life. You've got relationships outside of yourself as well. And one of the big relationships that I have is with my very big, sprawling, slightly dysfunctional Asian Australian family. And they're sort of conducive to comedy gold. And my mother, especially, within the first few seconds of meeting her, will launch into extremely graphic tales of how each of us were born, and will ask you to volunteer very similar stories of yourself. And, you know, all those stories that sort of made me cringe as a teenager about my family, I sort of realized as an adult were actually quite entertaining. I thought there was something more to them. So I kept writing them and then eventually submitted them to an anthology, and that publisher, Black Ink Books, who is my publisher now, asked me whether there was a book in there somewhere. So got to writing that, and that's the story of The Family Law.
Yeah. So how did you sort of come up, meet up with your publisher? Was that through your work with Frankie?
Well, no, it was through an anthology that they held a call out for. The anthology they were putting together was something called Growing Up Asian in Australia. And the editor who was putting it all together was a writer called Alice Pung, who had released a memoir, I think the year before, called Unpolished Gem, about growing up in a Cambodian Chinese family in Australia. And the publisher, her publisher, we share the same publisher now, realised there was sort of this vacuum in terms of this really strong Asian Australian voice, but that you didn't actually hear that much about, especially in writing. So they put that anthology together, had a call out for it, and I saw the call out and I thought, growing up Asian in Australia, I'm a writer, that's the theme, I fit that theme, and I submitted two long personal essays to it. One was about all the really hideous theme parks that my dad used to take us to during his custody weekends when he was getting divorced from my mum. So pretty grim stuff, but again, looking back on it, actually strikes me as quite funny now. And another one about my attempts to become a real man, which, you know, if you know me or see me, I'm a real runt of a guy. You'd probably actually see the humour in that. And so from there, they sort of read my essays for that anthology and thought it'd be a good idea to expand into a proper book.
Yeah. Was it ever difficult, I suppose, writing about the people that you know and wondering how they might receive it?
Yeah, look, it's one of the fundamental ethical conundrums about writing about your life and the lives of people who are in your life as well. And there are no hard and fast rules. I mean, look, I have a pretty good relationship with my folks. I want to maintain it like that. So I made sure that I passed stuff by them. But I think by this stage, I'd pretty much broken them down. They were so used to being written about that nothing really surprised them anymore. And if you meet my family as well, they are incredibly open and frank about the stuff that I write in the book. So it's not like I'm digging up massive family secrets to expose them or anything like that. And before I started writing the book, I actually got to interview David Sedaris, who is an American writer and, you know, one of my all-time heroes, and certainly the way I write this book was inspired by a lot of his writings. And I asked him what was his rule about writing about other people, and his response was, well, just make sure you try to write about people who don't read very much.
That's good advice, actually. Now, you're a fierce advocate for gay rights and gay equality. Do you see parallels between how different cultural groups are treated in Australia and how the LGBT community is treated?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm sort of a double-barreled minority, so being gay and being Asian Australian or Chinese Australian, you're sort of forced to be in a position to see things a little bit differently. When you don't really come from any sort of minority group, if you're a part of the dominant culture, I guess you can take those things like sexuality and ethnicity for granted. You know, a lot of white heterosexual men in Australia don't have to often think of themselves as white heterosexual men. They almost see themselves as neutral. But when you're sort of positioned as the big sort of other type of person, you do start to realise there are some sort of messed up ways that you are treated, and especially amongst, you know, the queer communities out there. People do see, I think, gay people as slightly less than, and that's manifested in their lack of rights to marry and in other areas as well. So certainly I think those things all sort of come together, and, I'm totally always there when it comes to barracking for those issues.
Yeah. I suppose the problem is sort of people allow themselves to be defined by sort of race and sexuality and that kind of thing. So it's not kind of exactly, you know, big bad society's fault. It's often our own fault, I guess, for allowing ourselves to be defined. Did you find that's the case?
I think it depends on the situation as well. Like, sometimes we want to say, look, we're all basically the same and we deserve to be treated equally, and that's certainly the case, but we also have to recognise, on the other hand, that we are different, and that's why we are often treated differently. And to sort of, I think the message needs to be not that we're all the same, but that we're all different and we deserve to be treated the same. You know, there are sort of distinctions that I think a lot of people are uncomfortable with. You know, we all are different, and I guess my stance is we should all be okay with that and treated with the equal amount of dignity.
Definitely. Now, I'm talking to Benjamin Law on Generation Next about the Emerging Writers Festival. The Family Law is the name of the book. Where can we get it?
You can get it at all good bookstores.
and some bad ones.
You should be able to get it at most good bookstores nowadays. I see it at airport bookshops, which is pretty cool. And if you can't find it at your local bookstore, you can ask them to order it in, or you can go to my website, which is benjamin-law.com, and you'll see a list of online retailers there, and you'll be able to buy it as an ebook through those links as well.
Excellent. Are you working on anything new, Ben?
I am working on something new. It's quite different from my first book, which was sort of memoir, first-person, personal essay-type stuff, very introspective. The second book is a book of journalism, and I'm currently travelling throughout the Asian region at the moment, looking at queer issues set in different Asian countries.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, sort of a big gay adventure.
Yes, I hear the working title at least is Gaysian.
Gaysia, it might be called Gaysia, one of my favourite words, or it might be called Homos of the Orient. I haven't really decided yet.
Memoirs of a Geisha, maybe.
Memoirs of a Geisha. That has also come up for sure.
Good. I'll expect a couple of royalties from that. Now, where can we go to get more information about the Emerging Writers Festival?
Well, I don't know the website off the top of my head, but as soon as you Google Emerging Writers Festival or Google EWF, the top hit will be where you want to go. And it's got a very good listing mechanism where you can see all the programs and all the people involved in those programs really easily.
Wonderful. It features an array of excellent writers, including Benjamin Law. Ben, thank you very much for joining us.
No, thank you for your time.
This is Generation Next on Joy 94.9.
Great shows, great topics, great radio. Joy 94.9.
This is Generation Next, wrapping up for another week. Another big show. We talked to Sarah Hanson-Young and also to Benjamin Law about the Emerging Writers Festival. Now, if you want more information about Emerging Writers Festival, it's emergingwritersfestival.org.au, and it runs from May 26th to June 5th, so it starts in a couple of days. Get along to that. A lot of very, very good and important and interesting writers speaking to us. That's us for this week. Look for us on Twitter, twitter.com/GenNextJoy949. On Facebook, you can just search Generation Next. The blog is GenNextJoy949.wordpress.com. Thank you very much for joining me, Emma.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you so much for coming in. This is Generation Next on Joy.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.